Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm amazed so many of you came out on this horrible evening, so that's very nice. Now, you have to understand, I know no economics. I can't possibly talk about my father's career, but I'm going to talk about the man I knew and also about the man and his marriage. I want to talk a little bit about my mother as well. On May 6, 2002, news programs around Australia carried the news of the death of an Australian economist, H.W. Arndt. It was the circumstances of his death that grabbed media attention. The 87-year-old was driving through the ANU when he appeared to suffer a blackout and his car accelerated and he hit a tree on the corner of the building where he'd worked for almost 50 years of his career. It was an extraordinary end to an extraordinary life. The news led to a flood of tributes from the man described by former World Bank President Jim Wolfensohn as Australia's leading scholar of Asian economic development for over 30 years. Hindsight was certainly that, but he was also a prodigiously productive and influential academic economist, an inspiring teacher and researcher, one of this country's truly remarkable public intellectuals. And he was my wonderful father. As I said at his funeral, to grow up adored by such a man, so charming, intelligent and fun-loving, was all any girl could wish for. Heinz Wolfgang Arndt was born in Breslau, in what was then Germany, but is now Poland, in 1915, which was certainly not a good year for a German boy to be born in. His country was soon to be defeated in the Great War. His school years were shadowed by the rise of Hitler. Yet he had an extremely comfortable cultured upbringing as the son of Fritz Arndt, who was a brilliant organic chemist. Heinz showed very good sense from a very early age. At age four, he was invited to go on a trip to the zoo with his family, and he refused to get on the bus. And it was only when they got home that they realised what the problem was. He had a toy bus which had wooden passengers attached with wooden spikes. And he, of course, realised this was definitely a tricky part. Heinz was raised in the Lutheran faith, so it was a shock when Fritz Arndt was dismissed from his job at the University of Breslau because he had a Jewish grandfather. Fritz moved to Oxford and Heinz followed. Unlike many people, most people whose lives were ruined by the Nazi era, Heinz always saw himself as a beneficiary of this historic event. As Heinz put it, the calamity of Hitler's rise to power led him to the incredible good fortune of an Oxford education and a life spent in England and Australia. Heinz studied the modern greats for 5 years at Oxford with primary emphasis on political science, and then took this further with graduate work at the London School of Economics. And it was there he had an event occur that was to greatly enhance his life. He went to a party and met this tall, striking young German woman, who was Ruth Strozel, who has become my mother. And I'm going to tell you quite a lot about Ruth, not only because she was the woman behind the man, but she was a very interesting person in her own right. Ruth Arndt was a formidable woman. That was always part of the attraction for my father. He met her in 1913 when she just landed on her feet. She'd just finished her social work training after her London School of Economics degree. But she escaped from her small fishing town in Germany after running into trouble after writing a very strongly anti-Nazi paper in her final school examinations. Her family was also at risk. Her parents were sort of dedicated social democrats and her father was a newspaper editor. And he lost his job immediately when the Nazis arrived in town. And her mother lost her position. She was a very political woman, and she had a position on the local municipal council. And the family was, you know, in very dire straits all through this period. They had regular midnight searches by the Nazis, and there was one occasion when there was a stormtrooper, all the family was lined up in their nightshirts, and the stormtrooper came in and said, "Who's that?" pointing at the picture on the wall. Ruth's mother had a quick answer, That's our grandfather, she said. It was Karl Marx. But my mother's essay made everyone really nervous, and so the teachers decided they better smuggle her out, and they put on a fishing boat and sent her off to England. She had 10 shillings and knew nobody. And she worked for many years, ghastly years, for English, the horrible English family experience. They preferred the foreign au pairs because they were cheap and didn't bounce her back. But eventually she found a kind family who taught her English and helped her pursue her education, and she got a scholarship to LSE. And there she met my father. And she wasn't all keen when she was told she was going to meet this nice young German man, because I think she didn't really want to have too much to do with anyone from Germany. But Heinz was very persistent. And he was actually then sent away for 6 months, interned in Canada, but when he came back, they finally married. And this marriage lasted over 50 years and was quite remarkable. I think they made this extraordinary team, really, this elegant, rather stiff young academic with his immensely warm, forthright and capable wife. And within 6 years, they'd come to Australia, and Heinz accepted a lectureship at Sydney University. Well, he made quite a splash with his first book, which was published in England, which was The Economic Lessons of the 1930s. But it was still he realised it was going to be really difficult for a German academic to further his career in Britain at the time. And so they came to Sydney. It still wasn't very easy for them. They had to, in order to get accommodation in Sydney, they found, they managed to share some accommodation with the economist Noel Butman, but he had to pretend they were Danish in order to throw the landlord to let them into this shared accommodation. And my parents were always rather keen to distance themselves from their German origins. They never spoke German to each other. And they were very irritated by certain aspects of the German character. I remember my father once complained to my brother, "I don't know why German politicians always have to shout," he said. But Heinz then plunged with great enthusiasm into his academic career. He set up a series of Oxbridge-style tutorials, which hadn't been the case here in Australia at that time, and placed enormous value on some essay-type length assignments, and get it to the students that come back after he'd marked them covered. He had this tiny handwriting, and his papers were always covered with this tiny corrections and improving their English, improving their economics. My father was very, very famous for the skill he put into marking people's essays. He had very excellent use of English. And so he then started to add to his list of publications to papers on monetary policy and foreign investment and immigration. But with Noel Butman, they also launched the Fabian Society in New South Wales and produced its first paper, which was supporting naturalisation. And then they had a real breakthrough, because Ben Chifley, who as Prime Minister wasn't an enthusiast for naturalisation, but he found the policy expedient to teach the trading banks a lesson for attempting to upset his banking legislation in the courts. And he bought 40,000 copies, which put the Fabian Society on the map, and it threw Heinz out very much into the deep end of Labour politics. Heinz was really determined not to be a typical academic and economist who devoted himself to teaching undergraduates and conducting esoteric research. And he was really shocked when he came to Australia at the lack of interest and knowledge about public affairs in general and international affairs in particular. And so he embarked on a one-man crusade to try to do something about this. And he wrote articles and letters for all the local newspapers, and he gave talks all around the country, and also did radio commentaries of various sorts. But as Heinz was settling into his professional life, and Ruth was left with much more difficult task, really, of creating a new home in a place which was far from welcoming to this new foreign couple. Heinz was, interestingly, apparently a very modern husband at that time. He was, although he appeared very formal and reserved, he was very involved in family life. Joan Button, who was sharing the house with him at the time, said, he did all the washing up. That was unheard of. And he was a very demonstrative father and so on. But what she really talked about was this extraordinary decision that my parents made, which was my mother had been saving up to go back to Germany to visit her parents, who she hadn't seen, who were still in Germany, she hadn't seen for 16 years, and saved up all her money. And then when she was ready to go, she discovered she was pregnant with me. And my father said, of course you should go. And as Joan Barton said, I mean, most people have said over my dead body, the idea of a wife going off by herself. But she did that, and she set off and did this ghastly trip back to England with these two boys, 2 and 4, and they're pregnant with me, and a ship full of Australians who weren't very nice to her. And I was born in England as a result of that, and she came back with a 6-week-old baby and so on. And all through that trip, she wrote every day to my father. I had this wonderful correspondence. She wrote twice on the day I was born, which I was thinking about. She's a correspondent, my mother. Anyway, so they came back to Australia, and about a year later, they moved to Canberra. And Heinz took up his new post as professor at what was then the Canberra University College, but was to become the ANU. And he joined his colleagues, Manny Clark, A.D. Hope and Finn Crisp, all men who, of course, were to become national figures. His appointment led to some controversy because Billy McMahon, who'd been one of his students and then was an MP, questioned Menzies in Parliament about Heinz's politics. This led to a bit of a controversy at the time. But it was only after this, in fact, that Heinz declared his political allegiance by joining the Labour Party, and he then became an ALP candidate, winning a seat on the ACT Advisory Council. But it was in Canberra, really, that my mother came into her own, and she'd been asked by a migrant education organisation if she'd be willing to give some English lessons. And so she went out into the community and dragged people in. She knocked on doors and she found people. She persuaded husbands to let the wives come to these lessons. And she had the room just filled with people who couldn't talk to each other. And she had Polish and Italians and Germans. They were all there. And my mum was the only one who could communicate with this whole group. And she had them around the piano singing songs. And she was just extraordinary the way she could bring the community together. And Heinz got sort of dragged into all of this. We had one of the first cars in Canberra in that area at the time. And he'd be driving the pregnant women to the hospital and, you know, fighting with the bureaucrats on behalf of the migrants he was helping with and so on. And it was an extraordinary time, a tough time for my mother, who, you know, living in this horrible little fibro prefab, no electricity, a lot of women were dealing with at the time. But she really fast up to find her place in the community and drag Heinz in with her. So he was, you know, pulled away from his very cultured academic background, I think, very much into the real world. But he always remained the cultured European, making strenuous attempts to keep up his knowledge of languages. And after he died, we found in his wallet a hand-drawn graph, which gave a rigorous self-assessment of his competency in reading, comprehension, speaking and writing in English, German, French, Italian, Indonesian, Latin, Dutch and Spanish. And then he added a postscript noting some knowledge of Chinese, Polish, Turkish and Japanese, but sadly too little for formal rating. And it was interesting, he always retained his very English accent. He'd get really cross when he rang people. And at first he'd say hello and people would say, is that you, Heinz? And he had a very distinctive voice. Anne Ruth, who was one of his students, commented that there was very little in Heinz's manner, speech or dress to suggest that he had ever spent a week in Australia, let alone most of his working life. And as she quoted from My Fair Lady, his English is too good, which clearly shows he's foreign. My father, most of his life, you know, would be adding to, you know, looking up dictionaries and adding to his knowledge of English. He was quite obsessive about, you know, maintaining his knowledge of working English. He was a man who was very rarely seen without his coat and tie, and you'll see in the, so that those of you who have read the book will see, we've even got photos of him doing the barbecue in his suit and on the beach in his coat and tie and so on. That was very much part of the man. But he was someone who just enormously enjoyed living in Canberra. He was a skilled landscape painter and had a great love of music. He had very distinct tastes. A friend remembers him complaining bitterly, one forgets how vulgar Beethoven can be. He was also a very civilised man. I think that's what a lot of people have talked to me about, that this man of intellect who follow arguments, their logical and extreme conclusions in writing and in his public discussion, and always treating with respect an adversary who was making a good case for his position. And in the book there's a fascinating exchange between Heinz and Santa Maria. And Santa Maria had written to a sort of critical response of Heinz's lecture. He gave a 1956 Chifley lecture in which he attacked the Labour leadership for failing to think out new economic policies. And Heinz wrote back following this published response by Santa Maria, very courteously, but really attacking the role of the Catholic Church in Australia and Australian political life. And then there was this exchange between them, but it was really interesting because they're so polite to each other while having a jolly good go at each other's ideas. And Heinz ended up, you know, sharing spaghetti with Santa Maria at some point in Melbourne. And it was an example of this. I mean, he loved a good debate and argument, but there was always this ability, this belief that it's quite possible to have an intellectual debate without getting nasty to each other. So in his first few years at ANU, my father was specialising in macroeconomics, particularly monetary economics, and published his first influential book on the Australian trading banks in 1957. But then came the big shift. He became interested in development economics, working for some time in India, and then he was appointed as head of the Department of Economics at a research called Pacific Studies. And that was the real shift, I think, which led him to become what some people call the grand old man of Asian economics. And this was in 1966, just after the Sukarno coup. He determined the time had come to study the Indonesian economy. And it took enormous charm and persistence to persuade the Indonesians to open their doors to him. The result was, you know, he really did set up this world-leading centre of Indonesian economics, which I think really contributed to the development of modern Indonesia. There's a very nice story. He used to go every year he was publishing this Bulletin of Asian Economic Studies, and he had to go every year to Indonesia to pull together information for this regular survey they did. And there just simply weren't the professionals available who were used to writing for a professional journal at the time, and he'd go into the fishing industry and find someone who knew what was happening in the fishing, and then he'd totally rewrite all the data they pulled together. And he was always scrounging, trying to find how do we get some information about this country. And there's a distinguished economist called Peter Timmer who tells of working as part of the Harvard group at the time, and he was warned that hindsight was about to come and they should all hide all their documents and data, because Heinz was very good at extracting things when you weren't looking. But I think that was very much part of this whole business of trying to go into this country and find out what was going on there when, you know, the professional background simply wasn't there to pull together the sort of publication he was trying to do. One of his former students and a very good friend of ours was past deputy chair of the Reserve Bank, Stephen Grenville. And he talks about what it was like to be a student of Heinz at that time. And he says, to go to Indonesia in 1966, immediately after the year of living dangerously, and expect Indonesia to suck with the devil, to cooperate with a neocon economist, and to study the Indonesian economy. This is a degree of audacity that would amaze us if we didn't know how successful the result was. He pushed our students into Indonesian institutions, which probably didn't want us to be there, but were unable to resist the force of his character. In doing so, he not only opened the doors for us, his students, to new and mind-enlarging experiences that we never would have been brave enough to undertake without him, but as well he made us a little braver and a little more ready to push at those doors by ourselves. Grenville goes on, I don't doubt this was the achievement Heinz was most proud of, not the shelf load of books he's written, although he was certainly proud of those, but rather the people he emboldened to try a little bit harder to make the world a better place. As a result of this shift to Asia, new faces were also appearing at the Aunt Sunday luncheons. Now, these lunches were very famous. We always had the Aunt Roast and the Apple Strudel, and we had students and academics coming in every week to be entertained by my parents. And these were also always very lively events because Heinz just loved holding forth to a captive audience. But my mother was there, adding to the mix, and this led to quite some controversy on occasions because she remained all her life a dedicated social democrat, committed to bettering the life of the underdog. And she was singularly unimpressed by pomp and circumstances and honours and titles and so on. Some years before Heinz died, someone came up to me and said, why hasn't Heinz got a goal? And many people had mentioned that to me. It did seem odd that my father hadn't had an honour at any time in his distinguished career. And a group of people decided to come together and they, you know, put forward a whole list. Everyone was lining up to be referees. We had four heads of foreign affairs and government ministers, you name it, they were all there. Nothing happened. And then finally, I sort of hinted at what and asked him about it, and he confessed to me he had an offer, but he turned it down. more. And after that, he also said to me that he'd actually had a much more salubrious offer a few years before under Fraser, and he said no to that as well. The reason? Ruth didn't approve of such baubles. Ruth had firm opinions on a lot of these issues. And around this time, the lively conversations in the Arndt household started to become rather heated, because, of course, Heinz was shifting in his political beliefs. They'd started off very much allied as democratic socialists, but Ruth never wavered in her political ideas. And so here she has this husband who does this about turn. Let me tell you, she wasn't happy. She never forgave him for resigning from the Labour Party over Whitlam's uncritical support of China. And she certainly wasn't happy about his involvement in Quadrant magazine, which he co-edited with Peter Coleman in the 1980s. Politics became this incredible source of tension between them. And this was really hard on my father. I mean, for a man who just loved leaping into the political debate and getting involved, it was always a big issue for him. There'd be something happening and he'd be dying to write a letter to the paper or write an article for Fin Reviewer, and yet he always knew he'd be in the doghouse if he did. And sometimes he wouldn't be able to resist and he'd whip something off and then he'd wait for days really wondering if anyone was going to tell Ruth. And I was talking to Margaret Easton, who was his secretary for 35 years, and she remembers one occasion when something had happened and he was dying to write about it. And he took a student stewed over it, and after some days, a letter appeared which was signed by Margaret Easton. He persuaded her to sign it for him. Well, Ruth actually became increasingly immobilised in her last few years, but she had this steady, because she was so involved in the community, there was always this steady stream of visitors looking in on her. And they, of course, were always subjected to lectures by my father on a whole range of topics, because he was so hankering after an audience in his last few years. And then as they left, Heinz would show them out. And if a selected few would be handed in a brown paper bag, a copy of Quadrant, containing one of his articles, discreetly showed as he went out the front door. And I used to get very cross with him about this and take him to task, you know. How could you let... You know, this is something that was so important to him, and how could he let her constrain him in this way, much as I love my wonderful mother. And he said, that's what I love about her. He loved her passion and the strength of her convictions. And there was no way he wanted to change her. So it was a very interesting marriage in so many ways. My mother was also just totally undaunted by, you know, intimidating people. And they'd go to dinner parties together and they'd come home and she would have extracted from the person sitting next to her all the details of his personal life, which is obviously where I got this from. And he was always amazed at how everyone told her everything. And then also, of course, she became a sort of confidant to half of Canberra about their personal lives. And thinking about, you know, of course, always included a certain amount of sort of sexual tales. And my mother was always very interested in sex, I think, and also it says something about my initial interest, I would say. But one of the things she did was, she, in the days when we used to censor books, there was all these books that you had to sort of sneak into the country, and she'd always get someone to bring them in for her. And then very conveniently, she wrapped them in brown paper and put them on the bookshelf, which made it very easy for the Arndt children to know exactly where we wanted to go for interesting reading material. But actually, as you would expect, my mother, of course, reacted quite well when I sort of hit the public eye as one of Australia's first sex therapists, I suppose. And the Arndts found themselves subject to quite a bit of criticism from their friends, or various of their friends, who were sort of shocked by the sort of material I was publishing. And they really reacted very well. My father... I think he found it a bit more difficult than she did, but he coped. Some of you will know the economist Graham Dorris. He remembers being dragged all over Perth as my father went from newsagent to newsagent to try to find a copy of Forum to show him. It was really weird. Of course, I grew up being asked if I was Heinz Arndt's daughter, and then all of a sudden he was finding himself being asked if he was Bettina Arndt's father. And he coped really well, I must say, although he did grumble about the fact that speaking publicly about sex was much more profitable than speaking about economics. Ruth died on March 20, 2001, on the morning of her 86th birthday, from medical complications following a fall. And her funeral presented considerable difficulties because she'd left us a note with instructions for her funeral: no religion, no speeches. The latter we ignored. At the memorial service, Heinz quoted the American writer H.L. Mencken writing about his marriage: "I can recall no single moment in our years together when I ever had the slightest doubt of our marriage or wished that it had never been." After recovering from the shock, Heinz was regained much of his usual good cheer. I mean, he was always such a positive, cheerful man. And, you know, and obviously this was a huge loss for him. But, I mean, as Marie Tate, worked with him for 30 years, publishing the various economic journals and so on, and she said that, you know, Heinz's happy spirit was just unquenchable. And he did his usual sort of rushing around, and he was working until the day he died as an emeritus professor at the university. And every morning he'd dash off. My mum used to try to control him, you see, and stop him. She was worried about his health, and she wanted him to stay home a little bit later and not gallivant around so much. But as soon as she was gone and he was off, I'd ring at 7 o'clock in the morning, he'd already set off to the university, and he'd go to his office and he'd go and visit all the Marie and all the other people who were part of publishing the journals with him, carrying roses from his garden and so on. And but he right to the very end, he was incredibly alert, and he was very frail. But he had one last trip to Indonesia in the last few months before he died, which was fantastic. All the old friends and colleagues sort of fated him. And just before he died, actually, Ross Garno noticed a French language book on the side table, and he said, "Oh, I need to brush up my French." So he was continually involved in this process of self-improvement. The death of his very close friend, Leslie Melville, also a very well-known economist, came as a great blow to him. On the morning of May 6, 2002, he made his usual round of the ANU, visiting all his colleagues, and then set off in the car to deliver Leslie's eulogy, and that's when he had his accident. The news of the death led to numerous tributes. We had letters flooded in from the Prime Minister and half of the Parliament and academics and ambassadors and all the students. I mean, there are students, former students of him all over Asia who are leaders now in various countries, and we heard from so many people. And the one thing I could think of was how Heinz would have been really tickled pink. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.